chapter 11, verse 17 is where we are at. I don't think I want to do much reviewing. I think everybody is pretty comfortable with how far we've gotten. We'll touch on it a little bit, I guess. This chapter is very unique, isn't it? It's a phenomenal chapter in the Bible. Mentions 16 people by name. Mentions four groups not by name. And it talks about their faith. We get into chapter 12, it tells us the reason for this list here. What is that reason? I'm going to require you to help me teach this class today. I cannot do all the talking. So, why did the Hebrew writer, led by the Holy Spirit, put this chapter here in the middle of his epistle? What purpose does it serve? Roger?
I think just have an encouragement. Like, look what they did under extreme circumstances.
Okay.
Okay. Stick with the faith.
They're examples to us, aren't they? Oh, thank you.
Also, with their faith, they still have the faith even though they haven't didn't receive the promise at that time.
Hey, Bob. I got no power. You got another battery? Oh, there we go. Well, that's getting loud, isn't it? Can y'all hear me now? I'm sorry, Dick. Say that again.
I'll say it shows that their faith, that even though they hadn't received the promise yet, they still had faith that it would come about.
Okay. Exactly. I love the way chapter 12 begins. He says, therefore we also, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses. Who's this great cloud of witnesses? It's the people we're studying about, chapter 11, right? That's the great cloud of witnesses. He says, because of them and their example of faith, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us, and let us run with endurance the race set before us. So that's his purpose in bringing these people in. They ran their race with endurance, didn't they? They kept their faith. And he's given us examples of those. And these are great examples. These are like mountain peaks, aren't they? Who is noticeably absent in this list? Not that it really matters. We're not concerned with them. But have you ever wondered who is left out? Has anybody ever thought about that?
No.
well, obviously the Holy Spirit picked these people out for a particular reason, didn't they? And it seems a little bit obscure, some of the things that he points out about them. Like today, we're going to be talking about Isaac and Jacob and how they were examples of faith. Not real clear what he's talking about there. We'll do our best to figure it out. But what about Adam and Eve? Very noticeably absent, aren't they? Adam and Eve weren't exactly examples of faith, were they? We can only hope that they came to repentance once they'd gotten out of the garden. But for all we knew, all we know, a root of bitterness may have sprung up in them and they may have never overcome it. The only redeeming grace that they may have had was their son, right? Who did keep the faith. Who is mentioned very first in the list. But they're not listed, are they? Other people that you think would have been mentioned or not. Why isn't Job in the list? Now here's a man who was obviously faithful, right? Whole book written about him and his ordeals and how he ran his race with endurance and how he kept the faith. Anybody else? Joshua's not mentioned. He's included with the Israelites at Jericho though, so you can probably say that he's in there. Verse 32 says, and what more shall I say, for the time would fail me to tell. The writer says, I just can't tell about everybody. There's plenty of other people that I could tell you about. But these are the ones that the Spirit told me to write about. And they suffice, don't they? Who in this list makes the biggest impression on you as far as an example of faith? And is there any question or any debate about who it is? Yes, Calvin?
I think it's Moses to me.
Moses?
Because he had a lot of faith going through what he did.
Definitely. Absolutely Moses did. But I don't think it's him. Does anybody else? Who wrote?
Enoch.
Good. Laura?
I say Abraham.
Abraham. Does anybody agree? Huh?
He didn't know where he was going.
No. Abraham. Abraham is the example of faith in a number of places in the New Testament, isn't he? In this book, in Romans, and a lot of places. But we're going to be looking at especially one event in his life that really shows. And I'm not taken back at all from the faith of these that y'all mentioned. Not at all. They are in the roll call. But Abraham, what he did on that mountain in Moriah was phenomenal. We just cannot comprehend how he could do that, but we're going to discuss it. In verse 17, it says, "By faith Abraham, when he was tested, offered up Isaac, and he who had received the promise offered up his only begotten son, of whom it was said, 'And Isaac your seed shall be called.'" You know, other versions says that he was tempted by God. James tells us that God cannot tempt man. He does not tempt man. The idea of being tempted has to do with someone putting an inducement in front of you to try and get you to sin, right? The word means try. God's purpose was to try Abraham. What was he trying? What was he testing?
His faith.
That's what the very thing we're talking about, right? He's testing his faith to see what? If he would obey the command, okay? If he would obey the command, he's testing his faith. He put a contradiction. He laid a contradiction before Abraham, a very significant one, okay? What was that contradiction? Yeah. What does verse 18 say? "In Isaac your seed shall be called." Right? The promise was, it's a threefold promise, but the one we're talking about here is that he would have a great nation, right? And that what? All nations of the world would be blessed through his seed. Abraham believed that promise, didn't he? Well, of course he did. And he knew that the promise was through his only begotten son, Isaac. And that's how it was supposed to happen. But how could it happen if Isaac is dead? God has made this promise and now he's telling me to go kill him? Now, there's one thing that saved Abraham. What was it? It saved him from this contradiction, from this conflict. What did he believe in? You're saying, Laura, that Abraham believed in the resurrection? Did he? Oh? Why not? You know, she may be hesitant to do that because there are those who say that the Hebrews, and Abraham was the first one, wasn't he? He's the first Hebrew. The Hebrews, the children of Israel, did not believe in the resurrection. Have you ever heard that? They didn't know about the resurrection. Have you ever heard that? What do you think? Is that true or not? Did Abraham know about the resurrection? Did he believe in the resurrection? Okay.
We know it was taught, though, because with Lazarus and his sister,
right.
New Testament time, or the clearly. First century, that, and some that believed in the resurrection, some that didn't.
Well, the Sadducees
did not. The Pharisees were a lot more than two tests, I don't think.
Right.
The Sadducees were didn't believe in.
Somebody turn over to Job 19 for me. What, Dick? Did you say Job believed in it?
Yes,
he did. Job, turn to Job chapter 19. And somebody read verses 25 through 27 for me. Ron? What did Job say?
I shall see.
He said, I will see him in my flesh. Did Job believe in the resurrection? Obviously he did, didn't he? Does Job precede Abraham? I think so. Job believed in the resurrection, didn't he? For sure. Now, well, simply, we just looked in Hebrews 11. What's the proof in Hebrews 11 that that Abraham believed in the resurrection? What did we just study last week? Or it may have been the week before. Acts. Is there something said about Abraham and Sarah that leads us to believe they believe in the resurrection? Verse 13? Is there anything in verse 13 that will lead us to believe that Abraham believed in the resurrection?
The strangers and pilgrims on the earth.
What's that mean, Ron?
That means that they're temporarily on the earth.
Right.
They do not belong here. They belong
right.
Somewhere.
Right. Sadducees wouldn't say that they were pilgrims on the earth, would they? They would say, this is my home, my final home. This is all there's going to be, and when I'm dead, I'm gone. But this here is saying, the writer of Hebrews here is saying, verse 13, he attributes to them that they embraced this belief, they confessed, it said they confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. For those who say this, verse 14, declare plainly that they seek a homeland. If you seek a homeland, that you're looking to go to somewhere else, it's not on this earth, then you've got to believe in the resurrection. How did the resurrection save Abraham from his quandary? Right.
But a dead son being able to raise up a son, you have to bring him back to life.
Right. Exactly. Now, this is no small thing. I look very disorganized up here. You don't pay attention. This is no small thing that happened with Abraham in Genesis chapter 22. Y'all turn over and look at that. It bears a little bit of emphasis here, I think. Okay. Came to pass after these things that God tested Abraham and said to him, Abraham, and he said, here I am. He says, take now your son, your only son Isaac, whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains of which I shall tell you. There are fathers here. How would you feel if God told you to kill your son and not only that, offer him as a human sacrifice? How would you feel? Devastated? Absolutely devastated? Is there any way you would kill anybody, let alone your own child? Is there anyone else in the world that you would rather give your own life for in protection than your own children, right? Can you contemplate being commanded by God now and given no choice whatsoever to kill your son, but not only your son, but the only son you've got, the one He's promised through whom you would be blessed, right? So what did He do? He got up, saddled his donkey, took two of his young men, he took Isaac, and off they went with their supplies, right? The Targum is a paraphrase of the Old Testament. It was written back around the time of Ezra. It says that the men he took with him was Eliezer, which was his steward, and Ishmael. Interesting. I don't know where they got that. but if that's the case, it's very interesting. Because there was that conflict between Ishmael and Isaac, wasn't there? But they went. How long did it take them to get there?
3 days.
3 days.
Before they could see the place. I don't know what it took.
It's a 3 day trip, right?
And it didn't get any easier all those 3 days.
Especially at the end, they had to leave the donkey when they went up on the mountain, right? They climbed the mountain without the donkey. But where was it they were going? I mentioned it a while ago. What was the place? It's called the Mountains of Moriah. Where was Moriah? What were the mountains of Moriah? Does anybody know?
Some say that's where the Temple Mount is now.
It's not just what they say. It is where it is. The mountains of Moriah are the hills of Jerusalem. There's a number of hills around Jerusalem. One of them is where the Temple Mount is located. It's not the highest. The highest hill is where Calvary is located. That's where they went. Start adding this up. Okay? Are you adding this up? So they went to Mount Moriah. And when they got there, Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering, laid it on Isaac. How much wood would it have taken to burn somebody? Would it have been this much? No, it could have caused some damage. Maybe even some sort of third degree burns, right? Would it have taken this much, at least, don't you think? And if any more than that, it'd be on his back to where he would have to burden to carry it. Now, when you were children in Bible class, you saw pictures of Isaac, didn't you? And remember, I did. Very dramatic. Abraham raising that knife to slay his son, and his son is laid out there on top of the wood. What did Isaac look like?
A boy.
Who said a boy, Carrie? He was a boy. How about how old do you remember him being?
Not very old.
12, 15, right? Does anybody else remember this? I sure do. He took this little boy up the hill. Tell me how a little boy could carry all that wood. Enough wood to burn himself up in a sacrifice. Some of the scholars I read said that Abraham was about 130. I couldn't verify that fact. I don't know where they came up with that. I didn't research it to go with that. We know he was how old when Isaac was born. We do, don't we? Huh? 100 years old, right? And Sarah was 99, right? 100 years old. If he was 130, how old would Isaac be? 30. Remember that age. 30. Okay, some of the other scholars I saw put his age anywhere from 25 to 36. Adam Clark, anybody ever heard of him? Yeah, Adam Clark. Commentator. His commentary is actually pretty good. You have to be careful for the error like you do with any man, right? But he's very scholarly. He is convinced that Isaac was exactly 33 years old. How could he come up with that conclusion? Why 33? Yeah. Elucidate on that for me there. Right. What's that got to do with it?
From the things that occur here, this is a precursor of the crucifixion.
Yes, indeed. It should be obvious to us by now. What were some of the things that we pointed out?
Carried his own wood.
Only begotten son. What was the nature of his birth? Miraculous birth, supernatural birth, right? What else? What about the 3 days? What was significant about the 3 days?
3 days with the 3 days and three nights in the tomb.
Right. Jesus, 3 days, right? And then he was resurrected. What's that got to do with Isaac? When did God command Abraham to kill his son? 3 days before he tried to do it. As soon as God said that, in Abraham's mind, his son was as good as dead. Right? Because he knew he was going to do it. From that point, his son was good as dead. It didn't matter when he actually died. He knew he was good as dead. When did he receive his son back from the dead, so to speak? When did his son resurrect, figuratively speaking, and he received him back to life? 3 days after. These are not coincidences, brethren, are they? God is designing a type of the antitype which happened in the New Testament. The life, death of Christ. Okay. Sacrifices. Isaac was a sacrifice. Jesus was a sacrifice. Age. If this is all that close, God doesn't play with this, I don't think. But from time to time in the Scriptures, when I've looked at different things like this, it seems like details are important to him. And here's a detail that he wouldn't overlook. If this is his purpose, is to paint a portrait of what's going to happen in the New Testament to save the world, do you think he would make this happen when the boy was 15? That he would make it happen when he was 25? He already knows that Jesus is going to die on the cross at 33. So it seems like he would make it 33 to me. If it's 33, that raises a little problem for us. Abraham is 130. Isaac is 33. I think Isaac could easily have overpowered his old father, right? We know from Genesis 22 that he kept a secret from him. A secret. He didn't tell him. Isaac didn't know until they got to the top of the mountain, did they? What did Isaac ask his father? Father, here's the wood. You got the fire in your hand. Where's the lamb? Where's the sacrifice? See, they haven't discussed this yet, have they? No, they haven't. What did Abraham say to Isaac? What did he say he would provide? Specifically,
the lamb.
He said he said God will provide a lamb. God didn't provide a lamb. What did he provide? A ram. A ram is not a lamb. What was Abraham talking about? He wasn't talking about the animal that he actually ended up killing. Ron, talking about the Lamb of God. God will provide a lamb, and God provided a lamb, didn't he? But anyway, they got to the top of the hill, and he had to explain now to him, how are you going to get your son to let you tie him up, right, and lay you out on all this wood? He's 33 and you're 130. You can say, Isaac, sit down. Like, we got to have a talk. Okay. And they had the talk. And what did Isaac do after the talk?
Submitted
to the will of God, didn't he? Did Jesus submit to the will of God? Was Jesus a willing sacrifice? Was Isaac a willing sacrifice? Why did God do this? Did he do it for us? And so we could look back and see that this event foreshadowed the event in the New Testament, and thereby we would know that this was his plan all along. We don't need that, do we? I think he did it for Abraham. Looking for my... Someone turn to John chapter 8 and read verse 56 for me. John 8:56.
Says, your father Abraham rejoiced to see my day, and he saw it on his flesh.
Saw what? What did Abraham see? Jesus says he was glad to see my day. Jesus, he's not talking about he was glad to see the promises. He believed in the promises. He knew something was going to happen. But Abraham was given a glimpse. Was actually given a glimpse of what was going to happen. And this is it. I believe this was it. This may have been what he was talking about. What Jesus was talking about in John 8:56. Because the things that he saw that day, he saw and afterwards ultimately understood this was going to be what happened. What was going to happen in the future. There's a phenomenal verse in Genesis 22 that I have never really appreciated before. Some of you may have. If you have, I'd like to raise your hand and explain it. Or just acknowledge that. Because I would appreciate it. I want to know how many of y'all have ever caught it before. When they got to the base of the mountain, and they were about to go up. Verse 5, Abraham said to his young men, stay here with the donkey. The lad and I will go yonder and worship. And we will what? What, Mary, speak up.
Come back to you.
Come back. Abraham said, we're coming back. Not, I'm coming back. Not, I'm going to leave my son up on the top of the mountain to pile ashes. Says, we will come back. Abraham fully knew what he intended to do once he got up there, right? He intended to kill his son. And yet he tells these two men that we will come back. Was this a ploy? Was this deception? Was he trying to deceive them so that they wouldn't be afraid and chase him up the mountain and keep him from killing them? No. What was Abraham saying when he said that? He believed that they were both going to come down off that mountain. I think that's what he was saying. Has any of y'all ever caught that before? Anybody? I got a couple of nods. Justin, are you nodding? I think that's significant. This man had phenomenal faith. And the thing that I want to point out to, and I think the reason why he is there in Hebrews 11, 17, 18, 19, is because he was not in as much of a conundrum as we think he was. He loved his son, there's no doubt about that. But his faith in God was such that he had really no conflict. F.F. Bruce was a well-known commentator, and he wrote something that was pretty interesting. The impression that we get from the biblical narrative is that Abraham treated it as God's problem. It was for God, not for Abraham, to reconcile his promise and his command. So when the command was given, Abraham promptly set about obeying it. His own duty was clear, and God could safely be trusted to discharge his responsibility in the matter. What do you think of that? It's pretty good, isn't it? What was Abraham's responsibility to God?
Do as he was commanded.
Do as he was commanded. And that was to kill his son. As soon as he was told that, he was resigned to obey. I got to do it. And I'm going to do it. But I'm not going to worry about the promises, because what was God's responsibility?
Promise come true.
Keep his promise. God makes a promise, the promise comes true, doesn't it? And Abraham believed that. God made the promise. God will make the promise come true. Abraham believed in resurrection. He had no doubt as soon as they got up there and he killed this boy that God would immediately raise him from the dead and they would walk back down and go home. That's phenomenal faith, people. And I think that's why he stands out in this chapter. Y'all got any comments, reflections on it? Yes.
Verse 22:5 and 10:19, they go together.
11:19, you mean? Absolutely. Yes. Absolutely.
And what you brought out of 5, I don't know if it was there, but I've never even looked at it that way. But we used to think, well, this is the only time that it shows that Abraham knew that that Isaac would be brought back alive or whatever.
Yep.
But here it is in 22:5.
Yep. I'm sure there are some to explain 22:5 away, but I don't think so. I don't. Ken, what was your?
You know, Abraham left the Ur of the Chaldees not knowing where he was going. God told him to go and do it. So he obviously blindly followed. He faithfully followed God's command. Desiring to please God, secondly, he was told that he would bring forth a son. And he tried to help God out with that prophecy and promise, and that didn't work out for him.
Right.
So I think Abraham has learned his lesson that, you know what, God's ways are not necessarily my ways, so I will be obedient to do God's will here. And just like you said, it's God's problem to fulfill that promise that he made.
I agree. I'm not painting any portrait of Abraham as a perfect person. We know he lied on two occasions to save his life, right? He was selfish in that regard. He didn't trust God in that regard. Obviously, he came through a process, didn't he, to attain the faith that he had at this point. There's no doubt about that, and that's true. But I think he stands on the peak here as an example. And God used this. He designed and crafted this whole thing to be a type of the sacrifice of his own son. He wanted to try his faith, but he also wanted Abraham to experience in some small way what he was going to experience himself when the time came. Okay? You think it was easy for God the Father to go through what happened on the day Jesus was crucified? Do you think he was able to distance himself from that emotionally? Does God even have emotions? Somebody say yes. Oh, yes. He loves, right? He hates sin. What else?
He grieves.
He grieves, right? He gets angry with people. Very angry. He gets wrathful sometimes. He's an emotional being. That's one of the reasons we're like him. He made us with emotions. Yeah. So Abraham is the one person who got the privilege, and it was some privilege, to be able to experience in some small measure what he was going to experience when Jesus died on the cross. Except the difference is what? There was no angel to stay the hand, was there? The angel stayed the hand. God, but Jesus died on the cross. Now, let's talk about human sacrifice. You know, there are people make a big deal out of this. That God commanded him to do something that was wrong. Is human sacrifice wrong?
On top of that, burnt sacrifice.
Yeah.
There's a difference there.
Is it? It's still a human being sacrificed, right? Mm-hmm. It's still a human being sacrificed. What did the children of Israel do with Moloch? What did they do? They caused their children to pass through the fire to Moloch. What was that all about? They were worshiping a false god that they thought required human sacrifice. And they would actually do this. Didn't Manasseh do that? Sacrifice his own son? And he was denounced. There was no doubt that what they were doing was wrong, and it was taught against. There's poor things going on here. Just because God commanded the thing doesn't mean he was going to allow the thing. God knew he was not going to let Abraham do this. But Abraham didn't know it. But he didn't have a problem with it either. There was no conflict in his mind. What kind of a lesson can we take from that? When we see a command of God, let's don't second guess the command. Let's don't try and figure out his reasons for it. Abraham had no reason. God didn't give him a reason. This doesn't make any sense whatsoever. This is a total contradiction. This is ridiculous. I am not doing this. Abraham didn't do that. It's a command, and he obeyed. And we should do the same thing, right? We should second command, second guess God's command. He's got his reasons. Okay.
He didn't do like Peter, did he?
No. Peter tried to step in, didn't he?
I mean, he did it right, but when the feet of all the unclean animals, unclean things come down to eat.
Mm-hmm. Any more comments before we move on?
Well, in the parallel of Jesus, Isaac wasn't a perfect sacrifice. I mean, it doesn't say specifically that he sinned, but obviously, you know, no man is without sin. So
that's
Isaac
true.
Couldn't be the sacrifice that Jesus could.
That's true. That's absolutely correct. He could not be the perfect sacrifice.
Just to clarify, human sacrifice isn't wrong in and of itself. It's wrong to murder, and it's wrong to worship in ways that aren't authorized. But this was an authorized way of worshiping. So if God had said, well, I'm going to let Abraham let him do it, and then raise Isaac up, it wouldn't have been wrong for Abraham to do
it. I think Justin's right. God makes the rule, he can make the what? He can make the exception. We're told that God is sovereign. What does that mean? I am sovereign. I will have, what does he say? Mercy upon whom I will have mercy. He means I do what I want to do. Now he's got to be consistent with his own character, doesn't he? He is just. And he's not going to do anything that violates his own righteousness. But God doesn't look at death like we do. We look at death from this side. This is all we know. This is our life. This is our time to walk on the earth. And there's something out ahead of us that we're very afraid of, aren't we? As Christians, we shouldn't be, but we still are tempted to be afraid of this thing. And it's called death, crossing the Jordan. And buddy, we want to put that off as long as we can. God doesn't look at it that way. People die all the time. And he knows you're just going to go on the next life, right? He kills people, doesn't he? He even kills Christians sometimes. Who did he kill in Acts 5? Did he kill them? Struck them dead. This is after the crucifixion. This is after the church began. So, yeah, you're right, Justin. Okay, that was easy. Abraham is easy. Isaac, it's a little more difficult. Isaac is put in the list. All it says is, by faith, Isaac blessed Jacob and Esau concerning things to come. Now, I meant to talk about this a little bit, and I didn't. All of these different statements begin with by faith. By faith, this person did this. By faith, this person did that. This chapter begins off with a definition of faith, right? Faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. We're told that we walk by faith and not by sight, right? We know what faith is. We had to have faith to believe that Jesus is the Son of God. Hebrews 11:6 says, but without faith it's impossible to believe him, for he who comes to God must believe that he is. We've got no definite hard proof, do we? All we know without the Bible from Romans 1 and Psalms 19 is what? That there must have been somebody out there that created all this and created us. That's all we can really know apart from the Word. But the Word teaches us the truth. Hebrews 10:17 tells us, by hearing, faith comes, right? So we believe. But I got a little question here. Abraham had a personal relationship with God, didn't he? God talked to him. Has God ever talked to you guys? I'd like to know about it if he has. When God told Abraham he was going to have a son, who told him? Two angels and somebody else came and visited, and they sat in the tent and they talked, didn't they? He was visited by angels. He may not have realized it at first, but it dawned on him as the conversation went on. These are not just mere mortal men, are they? And there's something very special about one of them. So where's all this faith? Some of these other ones, you know, you got to wonder the same thing. Some of these people had direct revelations from God, maybe? When we look at these, we have to look at what it is that the Hebrew writer is getting at. In verse 17, we did that very well, didn't we? It wasn't talking about his faith in God, was it? It was talking about in his faith in God, keep his promises. God hadn't kept a promise yet, except for the Son. He promised and foretold he would have the Son, and there he is. But the faith was about something else. What about Isaac? Why is Isaac being put before us as an example here, and specifically about when he blessed his sons? We've already seen how Isaac was an example of faith because he submitted to the sacrifice, right? Isaac, no doubt, was a fine person. Somebody help me here. Yes, Dick?
Well, we were studying the patriarchs here in the other room here, but seeing how we come up with that, that first one is supposed to get the blessing, which would have been Esau. You know, which is supposed to be Esau.
Right.
And he's going to give him the blessing, and then with the trickery and all that, with Isaac and his mother and that, but God used that because Isaac knew that Jacob was supposed to get the blessing and the firstborn blessing too, you know, and birthright. And when he was tricked, he didn't change his mind. He says he could have said, "Well, no, I'm going to take that blessing away from Jacob and give it to Esau, like he was the firstborn." He could have done that, but he repented of it.
Did he know Jacob was supposed to get the blessing before he actually blessed him?
Yeah.
Did he? What do y'all think?
It was told to Sarah.
It says when Jacob came in after he had blessed Isaac. This is Genesis 27. And Jacob comes in after. And he says, "Let my father rise and eat of his son's game, that your soul may bless me." And his father Isaac said to him, "Who are you?" He said, "I'm your son, your firstborn Esau." I said, "Jacob, I'm talking about Esau." Then Isaac trembled exceedingly. Why did he tremble exceedingly? Yes.
He trembled exceedingly because this is a continuance of what the point is of this chapter. God says these people do. In Genesis 25 and 23, God had said, "There are two that... nations in thy womb, And he said, and the one people shall be stronger than the other, and the elder shall serve the younger. This is being prophesied.
Yes, quite.
And he trembled because he realized this prophecy.
Yes. What did Esau do when he was being born? What did he do? He grabbed Jacob. I'm getting them mixed up. Stan does it all the time. It's okay. Jacob grasped Esau's heel, right? And he was called a usurper because of that. And now he's usurped it, right? The prophecy's fulfilled. But where does his faith come in? I don't think it was Isaac's intention to do this. He was tricked. He thought he was given the blessing to Esau, didn't he? And then Esau comes in and he says, "You're not Esau." But what does he say in verse 33? Isaac trembled exceedingly and said, "Who? Where is the one who hunted game and brought it to me? I ate all of it before you came, and I have blessed him, and indeed he shall be blessed." What does that mean? Can't take it back. Nope. Well, yeah. He could have, but he wouldn't, because why? Because he blessed him by faith. Right? He blessed him by faith. So anything else that you wanted there? He gave him a glimpse too, I think. Both of these were giving glimpse of the future. And the same for Jacob, I think. By faith, Jacob, when he was dying, blessed each of the sons of Joseph and worshiped, being on the top of his staff. Who were the sons of Joseph? Ephraim and Manasseh, remember? Right. And he put his hands, remember, on the wrong heads. And Joseph said, "Oh no, my father, you're doing this wrong. This is the old ones. This is the way you're supposed to do it." And he said, "No, my son. But Ephraim will be blessed." By faith he blessed Ephraim because he knew that he was the one who was supposed to get the blessing of primogeniture. Right?
He got the blessing of the firstborn rather than Reuben, his firstborn.
That's indeed correct. Absolutely did. That's absolutely correct. And he also prophesied about the future of these boys. He got a glimpse of what the future was going to be. So his faith, the faith of these two men are really what? The faith of the same promise that Abraham had his faith in, that God would keep his promise, that a great nation would come through them, and that they would be great. Same thing with Joseph. The thing about leaning on the top of the staff, do y'all have a problem with that? I wondered about that, and I looked it up. There's two Hebrew words, and let me see if I can talk about that. The Hebrew word shekah means both bow and worship. It's spelled exactly the same way. The only difference is the vowel points. And when Hebrew was, these scriptures were written, there were no vowel points. You just knew. Because you were Hebrew. You could read Hebrew and you knew the context. You knew what the word was standing for. Later on, the vowel points were put in and mistakes were made. These vowel points weren't added by inspiration. So the word is spelled exactly the same. If you put the wrong vowel points in there, it changes from bow to worship. The same thing for the word Hebrew word matah. It means bed. But if you change a vowel point, it becomes staff. All right. Apparently, somewhere along the way, in the translation, in the Hebrew points in the translation, it was changed. Isaac bowed upon his staff. There's the Reams version of the Bible takes us to an extreme, says that he worshipped the head of his staff. Well, that's ridiculous. That's not what's going on. He was a very old man who was laying on his bed. Okay, he sat up to talk, to his son. And after that, he laid back down. He bowed his head once he heard that his bones would be taken care of as he promised. And what's the thing about the bones anyway? Why were Jacob and Joseph so concerned about their bones? We're rushing a little bit right here, but I want to know. What's the big deal about the bones? He says, "Do not bury me in Egypt." Why not? What's wrong with Egypt? He says, "Bury me with my fathers." Who was his fathers? Abraham and Isaac, right? Where were they buried? Near Hebron. I want you to bury me next to them. Why would that be so important? Because of his faith. Faith in what? Faith in the promise. The same promise. He wants to be buried in the land of promise. Okay? That's where I want to be. This is going to be our land. I don't want to be buried down in Egypt. Don't leave me down there.
The emphasis is not so much on his bones, but because he knew that they were going to leave Egypt one day.
That's right.
And so they didn't take his bones. They didn't take everybody else's bones. The father's
family. That's right.
It's Joseph's.
Verse 22 says he made mention of the departure of the children of Israel, didn't he? And I don't know that God actually had to reveal that to him. If God's going to keep his promise, what's the rational deduction? What's the conclusion? We're not going to stay in Egypt. God's going to keep this promise. We got to leave Egypt sooner or later, right? We got to go back. So, and Joseph obviously believed that. Okay. Yes, Roger?
I don't know if I'm reading too much into this, but in Genesis 30 or 27, it seems like even Esau had faith. We tend to think of him as being sort of a faithless, coarse person, but maybe it was just faith in his father, knowing that once he'd given that blessing, that was the end of it. Esau asked for another blessing. He doesn't really beg his father to take it back. He recognizes the fact that Jacob was the supplanter, and what's done is done, and he just asks for a different blessing. I wonder if that shows his faith in God. It's like, yeah, I'd hope this wouldn't come true, but it looks like it is. Accept it and take a scrap instead of a...
Twice he says, bless me, even me also, my father. Oh, he was tore up. And he really, really wanted the blessing. He had faith in the blessing, didn't he? Yeah. We're told in the New Testament that he wept. Even though he repented. We're told he repented, didn't he? But he wept. Oh, Esau. Come up, Esau.
So I think Esau saw God's word coming true. I mean, he saw things happening that were directed by God and accepted it. Even though he didn't like it.
Yes. Do we want to go on? We've got about 1 minute. Okay, I'll ask you this. Who's the people we're talking about in the next verse? Verse 23. Bible trivia.
After the law was given.
Yeah, we're after the law, but who are the people? By faith who? Not Moses. Moses is going to be talking about in verse 24. Verse 23 says, by faith Moses was hidden. By who? Who hid Moses? Yeah, but what's their names? That's what I'm looking for.
Jochebed.
Very good. Roger got it. It's funny how these names come and go, don't they? Amram was the father. If you go back and look, Amram's really not mentioned. But what did Amram allow in his house for 3 months? He allowed the child to be hidden in his house, didn't he? At the threat of death. Jochebed and Amram kept that baby boy in their house for 3 months. Okay, we'll let Stan pick up there and any other comments he wants to make. Thank you very much.